As I look at the order of worship, it seems like the offering is supposed to come after the speaker, and so I'm wondering if I need to go on. Because I have the check for the message, and I won the lottery last night, so I guess I have to say something. I made sure I got home plenty of time to get a lot of rest, and found out when I got home that my next-door neighbors were having a rip-roaring great party. The worst part was I wasn't invited, except I got all the noise and reverberation through my wall. So I don't know what my energy level is. And it also strikes me the better part of wisdom would be for us to just meditate on the great outdoors, on the rain and the interruption to our routine, but also realizing that the earth is being bathed in moisture, which will lead to its being reinvigorated, and that probably there are implications for us in that as well. I want to talk this morning about a subject which I had to give to the church well before the election. And so I thought, why not talk about the reality post-election, no matter who wins? 50%, plus or minus a few, are going to be really mad. And I think without any great prognostication, that is true. So I decided to talk about the fact that in America today, we seem to be questioning whether two halves make a whole. Whether that reality on our money, e pluribus unum, really exists. I want to ask you a riddle. Where does e pluribus unum appear?
On our coinage.
Coinage. Does it appear on paper money?
No, on our coinage.
Just the coinage. Very good.
On the other side.
On the other side. Well, I would invite you to take out a coin and look at that for a moment. This is a participatory sermon. None of this sitting like bumps on a log business. If I have to work, you do, even if you didn't get the lottery. Or a check. What does it mean to believe that we are one out of many? Well, you've got to have a long-distance vision. When that term was coined at the beginning of our government, it was one of those goals that was far from being reached. And I'm going to speak about that in a few moments. One of the things that serves me well is the capacity to be surprised. And I dare say that once you reach the point where you no longer can be surprised, you're really already dead. You don't need for your heart to stop beating. And what are the things that surprised me today? Well, the newspaper. The myriad details of our daily life. Two elections, at least, are still undecided. The state of Washington and San Diego, far-flung places. And if you want to count the state of Ohio as well. We seem to spend billions and billions on aircraft carriers and the means to defend our democracy, but when it comes to having an election, we have the darndest time. It's almost like we're a banana republic. And I thought the real irony and surprise was that we sent observers to the Ukrainian election. I'm trying to get my watch off because I don't want to do a Cotton Mather sermon here. We send observers to the Ukraine, and Secretary of State Colin Powell, with a straight face, complains about the results of the election because the results don't jive with exit polls. And there is indeed a lot of room for fraud and manipulating of absentee ballot lists, throwing people off because they're felons, and so on. And we're very critical of another election when, if we took the log out of our own eye, to paraphrase someone else, we would better ever see the speck in others. Be surprised. Surprised at the fact that in our country we are reassessing who we are as a people at this time. How many of you remember an election that seems a long time ago, 1961, the 1960 election, the inauguration of John F. Kennedy on January 20th, 1961. How many of you were alive then? Whoops. Well, let's see, I was only 12 years old, 10, 11, somewhere in there. And do you remember all of the hopefulness and the exuberance? First of all, His Holiness Pope John the 23rd, in recognition of the inauguration, because it fell on a Friday, he issued a papal dispensation allowing the faithful to eat meat, whereupon President Kennedy had bacon for breakfast. Well, I know it's not a big thing, but talk about a new epoch, a new beginning. However, lest we think that everything was purely idealistic back then, let us remember that the same kinds of pettiness and jealousies, if not outright division, seemed to permeate. At the inaugural ceremony, Cardinal Cushing of Boston delivered the invocation and he noticed smoke issuing from the lectern. Believing it to indicate the presence of an assassin's bomb, the Cardinal slows down what is already being regarded as an interminable address, in the hope that when the bomb goes off, his body will shield Kennedy from the blast. What self-sacrifice on the part of a Catholic prelate. The smoking stopped when an electrician yanked, more or less at random, one of the wires running under the lectern. Congressman Howard Smith, Democrat of Virginia, walks out before Marian Anderson sings the national anthem. Smith later led the opposition to the House in the 1964 Civil Rights Act. The opposition in the Senate was led by that great senatorial person of rectitude, Robert Byrd of West Virginia. Maybe people change. Hopefulness. As Kennedy repeats the oath of office, his left hand nervously slips off the Bible, leading some Protestant divines to argue afterward that he has not really been sworn in. Leave it to Protestants to just keep on chucking. Robert Frost, before reciting his poem, The Gift Outright, as a prelude to Kennedy's speech, refers to the president-elect as Mr. John Finley, apparently confusing Kennedy with the master of Elliott House at Harvard. As Kennedy gives his speech, Lyndon Johnson, who apparently didn't think it was so enrapturous, is that a word? It's a lack of sleep. I make up words. Enrapturous. Look it up when you get home. Anyway, Lyndon Johnson, sitting behind him and in view of a television audience of 60 million people, notices a piece of paper on the floor, picks it up, retrieves his reading glasses, puts them on, examines one side of the paper, turns it over, examines the other side, and places the paper in the pocket of his coat in front of 60 million people. So much for being enraptured by a message. The chair in row B in the stands reserved for Kennedy's brother-in-law, Peter Lawford, is empty because Lawford has a hangover and is back at the hotel watching the ceremony on TV with Frank Sinatra. You didn't know that, did you? You walk out of this message, this service today, you will know things you didn't know you needed to know. Now I'm referring to a new book out about the inauguration. And other things are interesting about division within that election. There was a web of dislike and suspicion uniting the dignitaries assembled on the platform to hear Kennedy's speech. Eisenhower referred to Kennedy as Little Boy Blue. Truman, who was there, despised Kennedy because he despised Kennedy's father, Joe, whom he had once threatened to throw out a hotel window. Well, you haven't come to that yet, have we? Eleanor Roosevelt, another enemy of Joe's, had campaigned to prevent Kennedy from getting the nomination and declined to sit on the platform with the other guests. Jackie called the Johnsons Colonel Compone and his little pork chop. I don't think Laura Bush ever made a comment like that. Johnson called Bobby Kennedy that little, and I can't repeat this word, in a church. Bobby described Johnson as an animal in many ways. Adlai Stevenson resented the Kennedys for naming him ambassador to the United Nations and not Secretary of State, the position that he really wanted. And the Kennedys resented Stevenson for pouting about it, in which he was quite blatantly doing. And practically no one liked Richard Nixon, not even when all was said and done, Nixon. A man who during the campaign had insisted that America cannot stand pat, apparently forgetting the name of his own wife. Now, when you can get into the full sweep and the vim and vigor of life in these United States, then even though we say e pluribus unum, yes, sometimes we have to do it without a straight face. Staring down from our coinage, or up from our coinage and down from Mount Rushmore, are the faces of the great luminaries of our country, George Washington. Another great surprise. A book like this current Joseph Ellis biography of George Washington is on the top 10 of the New York Times book list. Amazing. I would never believe that people would be reading this. And before it, remember, there were the books on Adams, Hamilton, Franklin. It totally boggles the mind that in the midst of our fixation with Fox News and MTV, that people are still reading books that require a bit of work and a bit of discernment. So I am surprised, and that means I'm not dead. Or take the latest thing, the United Church of Christ ad. Have you been following that in the last week? The United Church of Christ can never get any publicity. They are the descendants of the Congregationalists, the churches that dotted the map in New England and throughout the United States, of which Cotton Mather and his parents, his father and grandfather, were ministers. I am descended from that lineage of Mathers. The United Church of Christ has wisened up over the years. They're not quite as stodgy, but they're not usually in the news, except now with this ad. And you may recall, if you've seen the ad, it simply has some individuals coming into a church with a big bouncer in front and says, "Nope, not you, can't get in. And the people are people of color, people of different sexual orientations. And CBS and NBC, and I don't know, one of the networks, I guess, finally let the ad on, said, "No, we cannot accept this ad because it's controversial." The ad then has, after this, these pictures that has, "Jesus never turned away anyone, neither do we." Wow, that's controversial. It's about time it's controversial. Wouldn't it be great if Jesus was controversial again? Well, I was surprised by that. Actually, so surprised I didn't know whether to laugh or cry. Which reminded me of the line from Shakespeare about, "The world is a comedy to those who think and a tragedy to those who feel." Or is it the other way around? Or sometimes you wake up and you're laughing and crying at the same time. The upside-down world that we have makes us wonder about the state of health of our democracy, especially when in other countries, such as the Ukraine, people are standing in line for hours and hours in sub-zero weather to witness to something beside what they're going to eat and what they're going to do next 10 minutes or where they're going to make their investments or what they're going to do with their money. In Venezuela, during the recall election of Hugo Chavez, people stood in line for 10 hours to vote. Who would stand in line 10 hours to vote? Although there were people that stood in line hours in Ohio, I understand. I wouldn't stand in line 10 hours for a sale at Kmart. Although there are the intersection of Harbor and Lincoln, it seems at 10 hours once in a while, waiting for the light to change. What happened in the last election? We were told, well, people are interested in moral values. That's like saying people are interested in breathing. I don't know what that means. We've had some statistics of 55% of John Kerry supporters said that Bush supporters did not share their views and morals. 54% of Mr. Bush's voters said the same thing of those who voted for Mr. Kerry. Well, there's not much new in that. There's, you know, people make their decisions. They have their differences. In addition, 70% of Mr. Kerry supporters said they were more worried about candidates who were too close to religion and religious leaders than about political leaders who don't pay enough attention to religion. And this was apparently a reaction to Mr. Bush repeatedly speaking of God and his faith. By contrast, 52% of Mr. Bush's supporters said they were more worried about public officials who don't pay enough attention to religion or religious leaders. People are ambivalent about religion and the role of religion, its official place in society, and the separation of church and state, which I know you have talked about and heard from this pulpit in the past several months. Some believe that the evangelical Christians have too much influence over the administration, and others believe that big business has too much influence over the administration. One critic believes Republicans use culturally powerful but content-free issues to connect to ordinary voters, in contradistinction to the Democrats who believe that self-interest would carry the election. Bread-and-butter issues, economic issues, and people didn't necessarily vote for those bread and butter issues. They voted for a vision of what they wanted life to be, and in many instances they felt one candidate was best personifying that vision, even if it didn't agree with their self-interest. For instance, to believe that if they support policies that help the upper crust of the economy, maybe in the hopes that someday they will be occupying the upper crust of the economy. And so it is, that's very visionary. To put it another way, the Democrats peddled issues and the Republicans sell values. And I consider these the four G's: God, guns, gays, and grizzlies. And I have to admit that Republicans did a great job in looking at what the prize was and how to connect the dots, how to get from point A to point B. They did what was necessary. And I do get tired of the Democrats whining and complaining and doing whatever they do instead of, if they really want to win an election, focusing on the prize and trying to not just pay attention to polls, but seeking to raise a visionary picture of what they want America to look like. And so what it was in this last election was it was divisive, and people were made to be fearful about a particular candidate, wrongly or rightfully. And if you recall the movie, I think I referred to this movie once before, the movie Body Heat with William Hurt and Kathleen Turner, you recall the refrain throughout that movie was, "Are you willing to do what is necessary?" And in this instance, the Republicans did. And I really congratulate them. They pulled off a real American feat. However, I do caution those of you who are the 50% that are sore about the election to wait until the Electoral College votes in another few days, because in the proverbial old saying, it ain't over till it's over, and maybe there is lurking in the shadows a God with a sense of humor. And you will have heard it first from this pulpit. Yes, we are divided about religion. And if I didn't know as much about religion as I do, I would think they're all nuts. Wouldn't you? Watching TV, the evangelicals, the evangelists, the televangelists, the street corner evangelists, the sawdust trail evangelists, the mainline, progressive, middle-of-the-road people of religion aren't really making much commotion. The mainline is now the sideline. And so the UCC church ad really captures people's attention because they are totally shocked that there's any church out there that really is trying to bring people together. And many in the country believed, perhaps somewhat accurately, Democrats in this case, are often contemptuous of their faith. And some evangelicals take revenge by smiting the Democrats. Bill Clinton and Jimmy Carter got elected because they were comfortable with their faith. And Representative Rahm Emanuel of Illinois, a former Clinton aide, said, "What happened was that part of the electorate came open to what Clinton and Carter had to say and everything else, health care, the environment, whatever, because they were very comfortable that Clinton and Carter did not disdain the way that other people lived their lives, but respected them." He added, "We need a nominee in a party that's comfortable with faith and values. And if we have one, then all the hard work we've done in Social Security, America's place in the world, college education can be heard. But if we don't do that work to connect with the vast sea of people of faith and honor them, maybe not always agreeing with them, then we," meaning the Democrats, "are going to be on the sidelines." I want to go for a moment and think about our country's history, because lest we believe that this division that we are experiencing is new, let's go back and think about some of these books that I just cited. In order to do that, now that the offering is passed, you may feel more safety in doing this. I want you to reach in your billfold and pull out a 1, a 5, I'll skip the 5, a 1, a 2 if you have one, and a 10. Don't worry, it's not a lottery again. I'm not going to come out and collect it. Although I did see more of Andrew Jackson than I ever thought I would in one night. Well, and I look at these gentlemen. First of all, you got Washington staring up at you with that powdered wig, looking very much like he's wanting to hide his dentures, which were probably killing him when he had this portrait made by Gilbert Stuart. When you read the book on Washington, or for that matter, the one on Adams or Jefferson and Hamilton, you realize that the father of our country presided over the beginning of a country with a unanimous electoral college vote where there were no parties, there was no dissension. But very soon, in the beginning of our country, Alexander Hamilton, who was the Secretary of the Treasury, and Thomas Jefferson, who was the Secretary of State, began to be at loggerheads about the future of the nation and how the nation was to operate, whether it's to be a strong central government or a loose government that would allow power to revert to the states. And by the time of Washington's second term, where'd that money go? Did I say you put it away? I might want to look at it. No, it's all right. By the time of Washington's second term, though he also received a unanimous electoral college vote the second time, and had to be persuaded to serve a second term, things began to come undone. And there was rebellion, there was Shays' Rebellion, the Whiskey Rebellion. There was a need to quell dissension. Jefferson quit the cabinet, and Jefferson started fomenting through the newspapers of that time all kinds of acrimonious comments on Hamilton and on Washington himself, all the time thinking he was staying above the fray, except when he got caught red-handed, and Washington never talked to Jefferson again. So things really were in bad shape when we get to the election of 1796, when Adams ran for president and barely eked out a majority electoral college vote over Thomas Jefferson. And throughout his term, remember in that time, the loser was the vice president. So you had the person who lost being in the administration. And Jefferson used that to great advantage to sow seeds of discord that made poor old John Adams. In fact, his book, the biography of Adams that came out a little earlier, is a fascinating study of subterfuge. And it completely dispels every image, myth, assumption you have about the grandiosity of our founding fathers. And mothers, for that matter, when you read about Abigail Adams. You realize that these were geniuses. These were people of incredible insight. And yet, how helpful it is to realize that they had their shadow side and were as curmudgeon and had blind spots just like we do. Isn't that wonderful? Do I hear an amen? In fact, I think the lesson is in this for all of us today is to recognize that we have our blind spots. Or, as a church writer years and years ago said, a church leader, and by extension every church member, and I would dare say everyone, needs to have a built-in crap detector. And for whose crap you need the highest sensitivity of detection? Your neighbor or your own? Your own! Because we can get so highfalutin and so sure of ourselves that then we rise above the furor going on in the wake of our actions and easily judge what's going on around us, especially the person sitting over here, over there, or very distant, unaware of the havoc that we are creating. And that is very true with a lot of our founding fathers. Jefferson, I'm a great fan of Jefferson, but he definitely had a shadow side. He was completely oblivious to his, what would you call that, passive-aggressive behavior. And that's before all the stuff came out in the last few years about Sally Hemings. But anyway, Jefferson, you recall, was responding to the Alien and Sedition Acts passed by the Adams administration, which sought to silence any dissension. So this was a little different than even what we're in. We think the Patriot Act is bad. Go back and try to imagine living in the time of the Alien Sedition Act, when even to voice, in print or verbally, a contrary opinion, especially the question, the pedigree of a public office holder, or the pedigree of their mother, for that matter, could get you sent right to prison. And Thomas Jefferson had this comment about that, and I think it's pertinent for us today. A little patience, and we shall see the reign of witches pass over, their spells dissolve, and the people recovering their true sight restore their government to its true principles. It is true that in the meantime we are suffering deeply in spirit and incurring the horrors of a war and long oppression of enormous public debt. If the game runs sometimes against us at home, we must have patience till luck turns, and then we shall have an opportunity of winning back the principles we have lost, for this is a game where principles are at stake. What's a telling quote? But the very interesting thing is that Jefferson himself, with his passive-aggressive behavior, was largely responsible for the venom that the Federalists issued out in these acts because of Jefferson's vertiferous. What's the word there?
Vertiferous.
See, this is an interactive sermon, isn't it? How do you spell that? Vertiferous, yeah, that's right. Okay, you're actually right. I'm just testing you. Rancor that came as a result of Jefferson's own acts, thinking he was probably saving the country. God help us from people who are saving the country. Or the religious leaders who are saving us for eternal salvation. To the degree you're wanting to save anyone, you need a commensurate sense of humor. And that's what's lacking in a lot of the religious leaders. And maybe Jefferson. I don't know whether he has a sense of humor or not. But I think he needed an enhanced crap detector. The thing about the Christians, and of course, those of us that are Christian and identify with them, you know, we are most uncomfortable with our own kinsfolk, aren't we? Like a family reunion. You know what a family reunion is? Aren't there people at a family reunion you can't stand? And you go and you have to smile and hug them and then go take a shower. But all this Christian stuff we hear, Maureen Dowd recently had a column and she said, you'd think the one good thing about merging church and state would be that politics would be suffused with glistening Christian sentiments like love thy neighbor, turn the other cheek, goodwill toward men and women. Blessed be the peacemaker, and judge not lest you be judged. Yet, Maureen Dowd says, somehow I'm not getting a peace, charity, tolerance, and forgiveness vibe from the conservatives who claim to have put their prodigal son back in office. I'm getting more the feel of a vengeful mob revved up by rectitude, running around with torches and hatchets after heathens and pagans and infidels and Unitarians. Oh, she didn't say that. You think the one good thing about merging church and state would be a new attitude toward the other, which is what Christianity is about. I think an example of this was George Stephanopoulos was on a show with Dr. Dobson. I met Dobson years ago. He was testifying before the President's Commission on Obscenity and Pornography in New York. I don't know how I got there. Anyway, I was part of a group in Philadelphia, interfaith group, championing values. This would have been what year? 1984? And Dobson was on the panel of this pornography commission. You remember, this is the one that issued its report in the vestibule of the Justice Department with Edwin Meese standing in front of the Statue of Justice. Well, you know the Statue of Justice before Ashcroft got there. If you don't know what I'm talking about, ask your neighbor after the service, because I really can't go into detail about the Statue of Justice, naked from the, you know, the report on obscenity and pornography. I thought that was something. I mean, what was the point there? I was getting this and I lost it. Lost my train of thought. Oh, yes, Dobson. Great. He should have just stuck with his... he used to be a books on children, raising children. Then he got tired of that, and that's when things went haywire. Anyway, I was there to testify briefly, and I followed a penthouse pet. And there's no connection between her and the Statue of Justice. But the point was, Dobson was really rude to her. And I thought, I had a very positive opinion about Dobson before then. I thought he was just a very very rude, so I got up there and did my part. But anyway, Dobson was interviewing George Stephanopoulos. And Stephanopoulos asked Dobson about his comment in the Daily Oklahoman when he said Patrick Leahy, the senator from Vermont, is a God's people hater. And Stephanopoulos says, I don't know if he, or Dobson said, I don't know if he hates God, but he hates God's people, noting that it was not a particularly Christian thing to say about the ranking Democrat on the Judiciary Committee, especially after that vulgar, unchristian thing Dick Cheney spat at Mr. Leahy last summer. George, Dr. Dobson, haughtily snapped back, do you think you ought to lecture me on what a Christian is all about? He must have been forgetting that, of course, Stephanopoulos is the son of a Greek Orthodox priest. So maybe Stephanopoulos can speak as a Christian as well. But the trouble is that the Christians seem to believe they have all of the moral prerogative to speak on their side, and no one else does. And that, it seems to me, denotes a gross moral blind spot, that more is going on than maybe they realize, or that if we're going to reach out in a pluralistic society, which we have in this country, e pluribus unum, we're going to have to discern ways that we can cooperate even when it seems that our short-term values are not being served. I recall a couple of examples, and I will close with this, on how this can happen. And one example is very close to home. When I was the pastor at the First Presbyterian Church, as I think I shared with you before, my church was being picketed by anti-choice protesters when I was chair of the board of Planned Parenthood of Orange County. And they would come up there and they'd say some pretty mean, rotten things in the name of love to my parishioners with their horrible pictures of fetuses and so on. And I said, you know what, we could probably respond in kind, although we don't know most of those words, or we could do something else. So we did. We went out and we served them coffee. And the look on their faces was priceless. And in so doing, we kept the upper moral caliber by not falling into their stuff and turning the other cheek, so to speak, and heaping coals on their head, a New Testament term. And the same thing was done with the Veterans for Peace. They have a memorial in Huntington Beach. They put up 600 crosses every Sunday. I don't know if they do today, but every Sunday they put up 600 crosses to commemorate the soldiers that have died in Iraq. They would put up one for every soldier, but they don't have enough manpower, person power, to do 1,200 crosses. But one thing that happened a few weeks ago was a counter-demonstrator, if you want to call him that, set up some signs that... Vituperous? Thank you. I got to keep using the word so it... If I had enough sleep, I probably could have used it. Rancorous signs in the midst of all these crosses. And the Veterans for Peace had to decide what to do. And of course, what is that temptation? To go over and really let them have it in the name of peace? Some of these veterans you don't want to cross, you know. In fact, one of these young Marines said, should we go over there and take care of them? And the decision was made, no. We believe in free speech. Let him have his say, and they went over and served him coffee. They caught that vision. And you know what happened? As a result of that, the man later, after the day had ended, said, you know, I'm going to come up and set up my protest to what you're doing. I don't agree with it, but I'm going to do it down the beach, and the reason is you honored me. And it seems to me that these are two examples of how... Though there is an element of the population that claims the moral high ground, it is the exact same situation that confronted Jesus of Nazareth in his day, or in India during Gandhi's day with the British occupation. There is that element that has ability to wrap itself in that religious, moral, whatever. And the way to get through it is to find actions and gestures, not the gestures we want to use on the freeway when someone cuts us off, but the gesture, I told you, I think I used this illustration. If somebody wants a place in the road so badly, what should you do? Let them have it and smile. That'll really make their day. Instead of what comes so much more easily, which is that oh, it's almost like a prime rib, not last night, a steak. When you chew in it, to feel that anger and let someone have it. Instead, resist that and try another way, and you'll feel even better. Like those of you who have been on a diet feel when you resisted the ease of temptation. Is our country divided? Oh, you bet it is. Is it as divided as it has been in great epic periods of our country's history, 1800? The election of Andrew Jackson in 1828? Wow, that was an election. Okay, take out your 20s now. You know, Jackson had so much trouble forgiving his enemies. Remember, his wife died. He said it was John Quincy Adams' fault because of raising charges of bigamy. And Jackson had such anger towards all these people that wronged him that after he founded a Presbyterian church in his hometown of Tennessee, he was filled with so much anger the pastor would not let him join that church until he forgave all his enemies. This is near the end of his life. Division, 1860, 1864. We can go on and on. We need that historical perspective to realize that in a democracy that thrives like ours, we have to have the long-term vision and hold to our values and find creative and perhaps sabotaging ways to undermine those values that we don't agree with. Believing that the great architect of history is using us as a pawn in that massive chess game. At least that's what I believe. Must be the Presbyterian in me. And somehow we contribute and help those pawns move forward, ourselves move forward, with an air of hope and confidence that the best is yet to occur. Amen.